The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. Airing first on WSFMLP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bersa Goodness.
The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email to let us know. You can find radio-friendly versions of this show of 58 minutes in length by visiting archive.org and searching for the collection called The Final Straw. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.
This week, Paulette DeToy speaks about the life and case of Leonard Peltier. Peltier is one of the best-known political prisoners currently held in the U.S. Paulette is the director of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, based near Coleman, Florida, where Leonard is incarcerated, and is also an advisor of the National Jericho Movement. For the hour, Paulette tells about Leonard's life, his case, his health, the resistance that Leonard was and continues to be a part of, COINTELPRO, and Leonard's art. You can learn more about Leonard Peltier by visiting the ILPDC's website, whoisleonardpeltier.info, where you'll find lots more info, Leonard's artwork, ways to plug in and do events to raise awareness about Leonard's case, and keep up on updates. You can also find the ILPDC on Twitter and Fedbook, and there's links in our notes. The Final Straw Radio is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, found at channelzeronetwork.com. Here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
In the eyes of the government, we are the enemy.
In a world where there is no government, anarchy rules. This summer, get ready for the most action-packed podcast.
We continue fighting because we hate all authority and love freedom, which cannot be given, but must be taken.
Such zines as This Is Not a Dialogue, A Crime Called Freedom, Party's Over, and many, many more.
For more text and audio material of interest to anarchists,
check out ResonanceAudioDistro.org.
What you say, what you say, what you say, what? Record like a boss!
I have an important announcement. I'm declaring myself the acting president of the United States. I hope I can count on your support. But more importantly, I hope you will do what you can to notify foreign governments as well as key U.S. lawmakers in order to solicit their recognition of me as the acting president of the United States. There's a precedent in this, the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro is the duly elected president of Venezuela, but his economic policies have been ineffective, making Maduro unpopular in his own country. Almost as unpopular as Donald Trump is in the United States. Recently, in response to widespread protest, a guy named Jose Guaido has declared himself the acting president of Venezuela. He wasn't elected or anything. He just declared himself the acting president. Several countries now recognize Guaido as the Venezuelan president, including the U.S., Germany, and other European Union nations. This sets the precedent, then, that election results are pretty irrelevant, and pretty much anybody can just declare themselves presidents of their countries. All it takes is a public rally in support, and other countries switching allegiance to the new president. So, here goes. I, Sean Paul Swain, do solemnly swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, from all enemies, foreign and domestic, and to carry out the duties of President of the United States to the best of my ability, blah, 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 so help me God. There it is, folks. It's official. I'm the acting President of the United States. Stop laughing. Final straw, listeners. I need your help. We're going to make history. Please send emails to U.S. lawmakers, including Nancy Pelosi, seeking recognition of me as the acting president. Also, somebody needs to contact foreign governments. Russia, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Venezuela, Mexico. I need their recognition. Feel free to contact Al Jazeera and RT and provide them a link to my declaration and spread this all over Facebook and Twitter. Americans need to know who their new president is. A walking dumpster fire with two thumbs. This guy. As my first order of business, I'm ordering the acting attorney general to have Donald Trump and Mike Pence arrested and charged with treason. As my second order of business, I'm issuing pardons to all federal prisoners, with exception to those involved in the Trump campaign. I'm dispatching helicopters to immediately pick up the members of my new proposed cabinet. Jeremy Hammond, I'm offering Secretary of Defense, so he doesn't have to hack into their systems again. He'll just be the one who generates the password. Leonard Peltier, Secretary of the Interior. The Cleveland Four, Brandon, Connor, Doug, and Scully, will be put in charge of the FBI, CIA, National Security Agency, and Homeland Security, the same folks who entrapped them. I know. Awkward. Postmaster General, Ted Kaczynski. The key posts at the State Department and ambassador's appointments I'll make from the liberated prisoners coming out of Guantanamo Bay. Fun times. I'll sign an executive order that unilaterally decommissions the entire U.S. nuclear arsenal. We don't need nukes. If we have a problem with some other country, we'll handle it the old-fashioned way. Their leader can get in the ring with me. No pinfall, submission only, tables, ladders, and chairs, Texas cage match. On pay-per-view, globally simulcast. Have you seen these other world leaders? I'd crush them, just like I'd crush the Donald if he ever got in the ring. Besides decommissioning the nukes, I'll decommission the U.S. military entirely. We'll then distribute the arms and technology to the First Nations people who legitimately still own the land of the United States. It makes sense to me that Apache attack helicopters ought to be owned by the Apache people. I'll order payment of reparations to descendants of slavery, to be paid the same way that the German government paid reparations to Holocaust survivors. We'll blast those faces off of Mount Rushmore, and we'll take down the Hoover Dam. With all that water running into Mexico, they'll be able to farm and grow crops and feed everybody. And then there'll be no reason for them to come north looking for work, especially when we give them back California, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas, since all of that still belongs to Mexico. Yeah, I'm going to shake things up as acting president. I hope I can count on you to generate the popular support I'm going to need in order to succeed. This is anarchist prisoner and acting president of the United States, Sean Swain, from the Super Duper Max in Youngstown, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new/old address at Sean Swain, number 243-205, Ohio State Penitentiary, 878 Coitsville Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read more of Sean's writings and keep up on his case, visit seanswain.org.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message. I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
So I'm joined by someone who's a member of the advisory board of the Jericho Movement and of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, Paulette Doté. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat, Paulette.
Oh, you're welcome. I always enjoy talking about politics, especially as I am the director of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, and time is crucial for him. You know, Leonard is going to be 75 years old in September, and he has been in prison 44 years. So I always hope people pay attention and listen and do what they can not only for Leonard, but for other Native political prisoners, as well as prisoners on the Jericho list. So it's very important, and thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Can you tell us how you got involved in doing support work for Leonard?
Sure. Many years ago, in the early 70s, I was a member of an anti-imperialist organization. And I moved from Los Angeles to Chicago. And while I was in Chicago, I worked with a group called Rising Up Angry. And Rising Up Angry was a white organization that was anti-racist and built in the white community. And in 71, 72, there was an action on the part of Native Americans called the Trail of Broken Treaties. Well, a group of Native people from the Dakotas came through, and we had a big fundraiser for them in Chicago to help them get to Washington, D.C. And the following week, there was a group that came down from Wisconsin, from the Menominee takeover. And in that group was Leonard Peltier and some other Native American comrades. So I met Leonard on his journey to Washington, D.C. And I have worked with Leonard and Native American organizations, including the American Indian Movement, since that time. So Leonard went from Washington, D.C. back to Milwaukee, where he was attacked by two white policemen. And he was charged with attempting to murder them. And when they went to court eventually, the girlfriend of one of the policemen testified that he had a picture of Leonard in his wallet. And he bragged to other policemen and to her that he was going to get this guy for the FBI. Well, Leonard was acquitted of all charges, and this policeman was later charged. So that has sort of been the way the state has acted towards Leonard and members of the American Indian Movement that resisted this colonial white supremacist attitude towards indigenous people, people who had treaties with the United States government. And so Leonard had continued working with the people. He worked in Seattle. There was the takeover there, in which the Native people were given back land. And now there's this incredible cultural center called Daybreak Star. And then in 75, there was an AIM conference in New Mexico. And the people from Pine Ridge had come down and asked if young Native members of AIM would come and live on different elders' land because of the atrocities committed against AIM supporters and traditional people on Pine Ridge by the Goon Squad. Now, the Goon Squad was actually called the Guardians of the Ogallala Nation, and they worked for a man named Richard Wilson, who was the tribal chairman. And this was, of course, in the aftermath of Wounded Knee. And he was attempting to break AIM's resistance on the reservation. So Leonard, Bob Robidoux, who was my husband, not at that time, but later, Dino Butler, and others went to Pine Ridge and went to the Jumping Bull compound and set up a tent city, so to speak. They had teepees and a big tent, and they had all these Native people, and they cut wood, and they had a garden, and they took Grandma and Grandpa Jumping Bull places as a way of protecting them. And this one morning on June 26th, these two white men drove onto the Jumping Bull compound, sort of at the bottom of a little incline. If you've ever been to the Dakotas, you know it's sort of hilly, and Pine Ridge has these little hills and valleys. And they came in on the bottom of the road and opened fire on the group of Native people. There was a gunfight that lasted quite a while, and in the process of this gunfight, both of the FBI agents were killed, and Joe Stuntz, who was up on the top by Grandma Jumping Bull's house, was also killed. But what is not known until much later is that same day, Dick Wilson, the tribal chairman, signed away part of the reservation for uranium exploration and to use as a firing range. And they already had extra FBI and military people outside the reservation because they were expecting there to be resistance on the part of the people of Pine Ridge to him selling the land. Well, in fact, what happened was because of the shootout at the Jumping Bulls, the FBI and the paramilitary swarmed all over this area. Leonard and Bob, Dino, and the whole group, this young group, there was four or five teenagers there, and some of the women were there, Neelock Butler and Jean Roach, and they got away. Some of them went to Sundance, which was at Crow Dog's Paradise, which is on the Rosebud Reservation. And Bob went to Kansas to go to Carter Camp's camp. And in the process, Bob and his crew were arrested. And Leonard had gone with Dennis Banks in a mobile home that Marlon Brando had given them to Oregon. And from Oregon, he went up to Canada and he was captured at the Small Boy Reserve in Canada.
So I think one of the things about America as a settler colonial nation is that the central myth of either the non-existent of Native folks, like the land was empty when settlers came here or whatever story. And then if it even says, oh, yeah, there was a terrible genocide that occurred over the course of hundreds of years, but that's over now. And Native folks are a myth. They're like, or a ghost. They kind of exist, but they don't really. And I think that that's a similar in the American mindset, a thing Native American resistance. So even like a little bit of background about, like, you mentioned the Wounded Knee incident. Could you talk about, like, I know there were some really auspicious acts and public and audacious acts that the American Indian movement was involved in the 1960s, or at least in the 1970s, like the takeover of the BIA and occupation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs building in D.C. that occurred, or the takeover of Alcatraz. So there was like a ramping up of this national liberation struggle among Native folks, including members of AIM, right?
Right. And actually, it wasn't, first of all, I think the myth is not that there were no Native people there, because we know from Plymouth and these early settlements that Native people were always acknowledged, but the genocide against them was ongoing. And as time went on and the colonial powers moved west and took over more and more lands, then it became clear that the Native people were in fact holding them back, so to speak. They were protecting their land. They were not willing to just roll over. And so the government developed ways of taking them out of the public. And one of them, of course, was boarding schools. You know, they went into reservations and just took children and sent them to these boarding schools. If you ever go to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, what is now the War College, and you walk to the back of their land, there is a cemetery there with these little bitty headstones for the children, for all the indigenous children that died trying to get away, trying to get home. You know, they were not allowed to speak their language. Their hair was cut off. They could not practice their religion. And so their way to eliminate them and take them out of the public view was to, you know, commit these horrendous acts of genocide. And then, of course, as America got more and more involved outside of the continental United States, Native people were already on reservations and out of the public eye. It's like now Leonard's been in prison 44 years and we've been doing this work for 44 years. And people say, oh, my God, is he still in prison? I thought he had gotten out. I didn't think about it. And it's over a period of time, you know, people do the work and then they have families and things happen in their lives. And unless you're really committed to being an anti-imperialist and an anti-racist in this country, you know, you just get bowled over with trying to survive. And that's what's happened. You know, I mean, working class people have tried to survive, and you don't always continue to do the political work at 40 that you did at 16, 17, and in your 20s. And so piling on oppression of working class people, people of color, these acts of resistance, you know, tend to have to be huge. The Trail of Broken Treaties is, in fact, the takeover of the BIA offices in Washington, D.C., and they were given amnesty after that under the Nixon administration. But Nixon refused to deal with them. He refused to meet with them. Eisenhower attempted to eliminate Native people by doing away with their land, by saying, you know, the Menominees are no longer Indian people. They have no reservation. Their land goes to the state of Wisconsin. They attempted to do that to Leonard's reservation, you know, to abrogate treaty rights. White people were given permission to go in and destroy hunting and fishing grounds. And so all these subtle ways that the government acts is not always open to public view. You know, if you don't create this huge resistance, there's so many things going on. People are just buffeted by trying to maintain. So, there was all these. There's a fishing struggles in the Northwest, and Leonard was part of those, you know. And there was a elder, David Sohappy, who was a Columbia River fishing person. And, you know, what he said was, every time we accept a decision, they cut more and more of our fishing rights away. So now white sports fishermen have more time on the Columbia River than the people of the Columbia River. You know, and Janet McLeod and Leonard and all these people that were from the Northwest, that was the huge struggle for them. While in Pine Ridge and on the reservation there was a struggle around Wounded Knee, the fact that they declared themselves the sovereign Ogallala Nation and had to, in fact, engage with the federal government for 73 days to just, you know, try and survive as a nation. And then, of course, after that, the backlash with the non-traditional people like Dick Wilson, who was part of the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, you know, and nepotism on his part, and all the money went to him and his families and his cronies. And that's why they went to New Mexico to the conference to ask the young Native people to come in and protect them. So all these young people who were there on different reservations working with elders, you know, were 99% AIM. And as they educated and re-educated themselves, because a lot of these young Native people were people whose families had been relocated because there was no jobs on the reservation. Bob Robidoux, who's Leonard's first cousin, Leonard's father, his mother, his whole family, 90% of them were relocated to various areas in the war so that they had some work. And they didn't go back to the reservations. So Bob grew up not knowing his language or the culture. And so in the 70s, there was this flow of young Native people back to the reservation to learn about who they were, how to speak their language. Dennis Banks and Russell Means and the Bell Courts had formed the American Indian Movement in Minnesota. And so there was this awakening, and it was part of a worldwide journey of young people to resist white supremacy and colonialism, not just here, but throughout the world. You had the big struggle in South Africa and then in Zimbabwe and, you know, the Mapla in Angola. And all these young people rose up to say, you know, no more colonialism, no more of this white supremacy. We want our lands and we want our language and our culture. And so the American Indian Movement, just like the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army and the Brown Berets here in the United States, were part of that same international movement to resist. And as white people, you had white people who stood up and became allies. The Prairie Fire Organization, you know, Wounded Knee Offense Defense Committees. There were all kinds of organizations that built solidarity with these national liberation struggles as a way to struggle within the white community to deal with the incredible amount of racism, you know, that had been built up these centuries. So it was a wonderful, pretty exciting time to be alive, you know, to understand that we are a global community and that we must support and resist these European, this white colonialism, this white supremacy, which continues today, which is goes right up to this whole thing with Nathan Phillips. That was just happened in the Indigenous People's March. You know, this young guy with this smirk could have been Donald Trump for the way he disrespected Native people and their right to march and protest, you know, and to resist colonialism. So it, you know, it hasn't changed. And Leonard and other Native political prisoners face this all the time.
This is the Final Straw Radio, and I'm Bursa Goodness. You're hearing my conversation with Paulette DeToy of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. More info at whoisleonardpeltier.info.
And that's why I think it was important to reach out to you and try to have this conversation, because you've got a long memory and a long experience of being involved in these things, and I really appreciate you sharing that. So you mentioned Leonard's family during the war having to relocate for jobs and people coming back to their communities and trying to relearn what was stolen through the United States government's active attempts over centuries to disconnect people from their land base and from their language, their culture, and their spirituality. Can you talk about, like, a little bit about Leonard as he was growing up, as you're aware? Like, what kind of situation did he have, and how did he come to AIM?
I didn't know Leonard as a young man, but I visit Leonard on his legal team, so I visit him. And like I said, I've known Leonard since the 70s and have worked on his trial. His mother and father I both met. And of course, I was married to Bob Robidoux, who is his first cousin, and was his co-defendant. So, you know, I met and lived with the family. And so growing up, Leonard was raised on the reservation. He was raised by his grandmother and his grandfather. He lived on a reservation, which is called Turtle Mountain, which is in the far north of North Dakota. It's right practically on the border with Canada. And he grew up on the reservation and learned about the hardships, government misconduct. You know, they are treaty people. They have rights under treaty to food and to, you know, other amenities. And the government made it incredibly difficult for Native people to exist. There was no jobs for them on the reservation. You could be a hunter and maybe you were a farmer, but it wasn't like you could, you know, go down and just get a job when you got out of high school. And you were lucky if you went to high school because you had to go to work to help provide monies for your family. So at an early age, Leonard went with his grandpa to these meetings on the reservation to try and build Native resistance organizations that dealt within the Native communities there. And then when he was about in his early teens, he left and moved to Portland, Oregon and other places. And he lived with Bob's family. Bob's dad, Bill Robidoux, was Leonard's uncle. Bob's dad and Alvina, who was Leonard's mother, were brother and sister. And so he came and worked and lived with Bill and Bob and their family, and they had 10 children, and they were migrant farm workers. So they traveled around and picked strawberries, they picked beans, they lived in Wenatchee, Washington, and picked apples. And to this day, Leonard said, you know, I'm never going to eat another strawberry, because he was tall. And to pick strawberries, you know, you're bent over, you're running, you have to go through these fields practically on your knees. And he said, you know, if nothing else, he said, you know, people don't realize what it is to be a farm worker. You know, this myth that somehow farm workers are these terrible people. He said, you know, he said it was families like ours, you know, where everybody but a 10-year-old worked in the field so the families could survive. So Leonard did that. And then in his early 20s, he went and learned to be a mechanic. And so his uncle had taught him, and he had a small garage, and he worked in the Northwest up in Seattle. And that's where he was involved with Native resistance there around the fishing struggle and stuff. So when land is an army base is closed down, the first person to get offered that land, it goes back to the Native people from that area. And so Leonard and a group of people went into Fort Lawton the night before the base was closed. And so the next day it was turned over, and they were there, and they took the land back. And there was an on and off long struggle. And eventually, the native people got the land back and built out there on the sound this incredibly beautiful place, Daybreak Star, which is a cultural center. It has child care and every type of thing that a native person could use on off of a reservation was provided. And Leonard was part of that struggle as well. So he has always been grounded in his community as a person who has character and resistance and is always willing to stand up and be counted and say, you know, no more. And so that's why he's in prison, because he has said no more. And they resisted there in Ogallala. And it was a horrible day. And like Bob said, their lives were changed forever when they found out that these two white men that were shooting at them were actually FBI agents. And they knew then that the government would hunt them down. And they did. And, you know, that's why Leonard's in prison today. And the FBI, of course, has its own take on this, you know, and they blame the native people. You know, why did you do this? But then why was the federal government willing to send two white guys, white men, into a place where they knew there was a camp? They didn't go in with their badges. They went in with their guns. And so it's always been, it was Leonard's fault that this happened. It was not Leonard's fault. It was not the native people's fault. It was, again, white government thinking that they are superior and that they have a right to act in a totally disrespectful way to anybody who is trying to live and resist this government. So that's sort of how Leonard grew up. You know, he was a migrant worker. He grew up on a reservation that was facing termination, and he worked with the elders there. So he has lived a life, you know, of resistance.
And it's terrible that 44 years, as you said, of that life has been behind bars.
Right. I mean, he was in his 30s when this happened. He's 74. You know, he has grandchildren and great-grandchildren that he's never met. He's here in Florida. His family is in the Dakotas, which is, you know, like 23-hour drive. It's way, you know, it's like a 3-day drive when we left North Dakota to come here to put up our defense committee house. It was a 3-day drive. And, you know, people who are working class do not have that kind of time nor money to make these trips. It's $1,000 for airfare and a place to stay and to buy food and to rent a car to visit somebody in Coleman, Florida, when you live in Fargo, North Dakota. So, you know, it's just an incredibly hard time for family. Both his parents passed away, and he was never allowed, you know, to go to funerals.
So there's a long line, as long as the United States government, and I'm sure this doesn't stand just for the United States government, but as long as the United States government has existed, there have been repressive elements within it or apparatuses, tools that have been wielded by settler colonial white supremacy, patriarchy against the subject populations. At the time of Wounded Knee and at the time of the activities for which Leonard was incarcerated, one of these repressive tools was called COINTELPRO. Can you talk a little bit about the counterintelligence program of the FBI and the targeting of indigenous activists at this time and how that shaped the case that Peltier?
Sure. Well, I mean, COINTELPRO was a national policy by the FBI to create distrust within movements. So it was not just within the American Indian movement. And Ward Churchill has a book out called COINTELPRO, And because people did not believe it, that he put out, he and Jim VanderWaal put out a second book called COINTELPRO Papers, which are documents right from the FBI's mouth saying, this is what we're going to do. So one of the things that they did in South Dakota was that they set out this rumor that, quote, the dog soldiers were going to be attacking towns in South Dakota, and white people better be careful. And this is all documented. They did the same thing within the Black Panther Party when they set up us United Slaves against the Black Panther Party in the shootout at UCLA. They've done it with all these movements. They focus on people. They send letters to one side or the other stating these people are doing something. And there was called the church investigation, which actually exposed this. And you can actually, there's all kind of documentation on COINTELPRO, and it's still alive today. What happens is there might be something going on. You saw it with Red Fawn, right? Red Fawn is this Native woman that was at Standing Rock, and there was
Red Fawn Fallis, yeah,
a big gathering, and she was there with her boyfriend, and a gun fell out of her pocket, supposedly, that her boyfriend had given her to hold, and he turns out to be an agent, and she ends up doing 7 years because she already had been charged with something prior to that. And so they set up.
So she was a felon at that point, yeah.
The pipeline resistance. And so all this type of manipulation by the government to create unrest, to create distrust amongst activists, is called the counterintelligence program. And like I said, the seminal book on that is by Ward Churchill and Jim VanderWaal called COINTELPRO. And he looks at the different movements, the Brown Berets, the Black Panther Party, the American Indian Movement, white anti-imperialists, and shows how through documentation of their own papers that they attempted to destroy these different resistance groups. And same way with Wounded Knee. By the time Wounded Knee was over and they had arrested so many Native people, you know, they said, the AIM said, you know, we spent more time now fighting in the courts than we actually did in resisting. And so that was another example of how they created this chaos and, you know, kept people fighting in the courts when they should have been out, you know, working in their communities.
So Mr. Peltier's conviction relied on a lot of questionable, if not illegal or whatever, unjust activities by the prosecutors, such as withholding evidence, questionable forensics and ballistics, and coerced testimony that's led many, including Amnesty International in 2010, to call the trial unfair. Can you talk about, for someone who's maybe coming to this and saying, well, it sounds like a he said, she said issue, and they went through the court system, and therefore, like, there must have been some justice to the conviction. Can you talk about the details of the trial that are in dispute?
Sure.
And is a new trial demanded by Peltier and his supporters?
Okay, so the first thing is Leonard was arrested in Canada. And in order to bring him back, they had to convince the Canadian government that he had committed, you know, acts that the Canadians would consider offenses too. So in order to do this, the FBI created a false affidavit. In fact, they created three affidavits. And they used this woman named Myrtle Poorbear, who was mentally challenged and emotionally challenged. And they took her to a motel and held her there and threatened her with the removal of her daughter and that they would treat her like they did with Annie Mae, who's Annie Mae Aquash, and cut off her hands if she did not help them. Well, she was not a very literate person. So the first thing that they helped her write was so weird that the federal government in Canada said, we cannot accept this. And so they went back and they wrote one that they forced her to sign that was submitted to the Canadian government, which was lies, that she had been there that day, that Leonard had forced her to watch him shoot these agents. And her parents and her sister testified that Myrtle was not there that day, that Myrtle was in fact with them on the other side of the reservation. But because of Myrtle's mental state and emotional upset, she went along with what the FBI said. In fact, she was used in a couple of AIM trials to say that these different AIM people had done things, and they used her. And so Myrtle was used, and this lie, this affidavit was submitted by the U.S. government to the Canadian government. The Canadian government accepted it and said, we will not return him if there is a death penalty on the table. So they removed the death penalty and charged Leonard with two counts of murder of these two FBI agents. And so just bringing him back from Canada was a lie. And it was a lie between governments. You know, it was a lie by the United States government to Canada, which eventually they had to admit. One of the prosecutors in the case in a 60-minute episode around Leonard, done, I think it was done in the 80s, he says, you know, I don't care if it was a lie. We got him back, you know, and I do the same thing again today.
Huh.
And so they themselves have admitted it and have had to sort of apologize to the Canadian government for lying to supposedly our allies. So just bringing him back from Canada started the whole series of lies that they've used against Leonard. Now, in order to understand Leonard's trial, you have to also look at the trial of Bob Robidoux and Dino Butler, which was held earlier because Leonard was in Canada fighting extradition. Bob and Dino were charged with the same as Leonard, and their plea was not guilty on the grounds of self-defense. And they were allowed to put on this evidence that showed what was happening on the reservation, this reign of terror by Dick Wilson's administration. They had the Attorney General of the United States talk about the fact that you have the right of self-defense. If somebody comes and starts shooting at you, you can shoot back. And so Bob and Dino were found not guilty. And the FBI said, someone is going to pay and we're going to get Peltier. And so they moved the trial. Bob and Dino's trial was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And they took it away from the judge and they moved it to a judge in North Dakota named Benson. And Benson said openly, I'll not allow any testimony against the government or the FBI. And so everything that Bob and Dino was allowed to present, Benson ruled against it and did not allow it to happen. He did not allow a lot of the evidence of the social injustice that was going on to show why these Native people would have automatically fired against somebody that was firing at them and not waved the flag and said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to roll over. So that was done. Then the ballistics that you brought up was also lies, and they almost got caught. In fact, they did get caught, and they had to put their head man, Hodges, back on the stand and say, oh, pardon me, Your Honor, I mistook myself. Yes, other people have done this, and no, we don't know exactly what gun fired that bullet. And then, so that happens. There was a woman on the jury who was a racist, and they actually had a hearing where friends of hers had testified that she had made statements that she didn't think she could be a fair jury because she didn't trust Indian people. And she was allowed to stay on the jury. So all of these things, you know, built up. When they tried to bring Myrtle Poor Bear in to show how convoluted the government had been to get these false affidavits, the judge ruled her as incompetent to stand trial. And he said, you know, if she got to testify, this would be a huge mark against the judicial system. So he ruled that she could not testify. And so Leonard was convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder and aiding and abetting in the death of these 2 FBI agents. Now, eventually, Leonard goes and has an appeal. And one of his appeals, that they say, the judges that are sitting on the appellate say to Crooks, who was the prosecutor, well, we don't see where there's any indication that Mr. Peltier committed murder. And Crooks said, well, Your Honor, he said, we don't really know who killed these agents, nor what role Mr. Peltier had in the firefight that day. And you would think that by them saying they didn't know this, that Leonard would have won the appeal. But because of terminology, the judges said no, that was not enough proof that he should get a new trial. So even at the appellate level, the role played by English language, played by culture, and by just U.S. law has always ended up with people saying, oh, it was so close. I wish I could have ruled for him, but they didn't. And again, in West 57th Street and in the 60-minute episodes that you can see on YouTube, by the way, this judge, his name was Judge Haney, and he said, that was the hardest decision I ever had to make. And he said, I believe the government as equally responsible as Mr. Peltier, but we could not rule in his favor. So, you know, it's just been this incredible...
it's a travesty.
What to call it. It's more than a travesty. You know, it's like white supremacy putting some more nails into the resistance of Native people just to be human beings, you know, just to have language, to have their sun dance, to practice their religion, whether it's a peyote ceremony or a Uwipi ceremony, and not have white people tell them what they can do, because white people seem to feel that, you know, they were the colonialists. And, you know, it's called the doctrine of discovery, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you, as a colonizer, go onto the land where there are indigenous people, and they are not, quote, Christians, then you as a Christian have a right to take their land from them, because as a Christian, you believe in this God, and you believe the fact that as a white person, you are going to help them. You're going to bring them along. You're going to turn them into white people. And throughout the world, people of color and indigenous people have resisted that and said, you know, my religion is just as important as your religion and my language and my culture. And the colonial mentality has gone along with the doctrine of discovery. In fact, Ruth Ginsburg, you know, who everybody loves, ruled in favor of the doctrine of discovery against Native people 3 years ago. That's how pervasive it is that someone who people are holding up as this incredible, wonderful person still rules that the doctrine of discovery is more important than the rights of indigenous people for their land. So, I mean, it's just mind-boggling to think how people buy into this myth, this myth of white supremacy. It's not a myth, actually, I should say the reality of white supremacy.
To quote KRS-One, there can never be justice on stolen land.
Right.
This is The Final Straw Radio, and I'm Bursa Goodness. You're hearing my conversation with Paulette DeToy of the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. More info at whoisleonardpeltier.info.
When the court system is based on, I mean, it is fundamentally based on the presumption that this institution can be just added on to, just cookie-cuttered and put onto this continent, and that it has legitimacy to even judge any situation, like to question its fundamental basis, the central contradiction, a Marxist might say, of like the existence of the settler colonial state in this territory, it's a fundamental flaw of the system that it can't question its own existence.
Right, exactly. Because if it does, then it has to admit that they've lied. You know, it has to admit that, in fact, they came as a power, and that to them, power was more important than the humanity of the people that lived there.
Or the people that it brought over in chattel slavery.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
So at the appellate level, you said that the judges couldn't or refused to even take the step towards a new trial for Leonard. Assuming that Leonard doesn't get a pardon or commutation from the Trump administration or whoever follows, he won't be up for parole for another hearing until 2024 when he's aged, I think, 79. How is Leonard Peltier's health, and is there grounds for demand of a medical release of this elderly prisoner who's been in prison off and on since 1977?
All right, so right now what the committee is doing is we are attempting to get Leonard a transfer from Coleman, Florida, which is a U.S. penitentiary, to Oxford, Wisconsin, which is a federal correctional institution. Because of Leonard's time and good time, his security clearance has been reduced, so he does not need to be held in a penitentiary. He is eligible to be moved to a federal correctional institution. And the one that Leonard is requesting to be moved to is in Oxford, Wisconsin, which is 466 miles from his sister's house in Fargo, North Dakota. That will be the closest that he has ever been to his family. And the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, the philosophy is you should be within 500 miles of your home. Well, that has never happened for Leonard before. He's either been in Lompoc, California, or Coleman, Florida, you know, thousands of miles from his home. So he wants to be moved closer to home, and it's also just an hour and a half from Rochester, Minnesota, where the Mayo Clinic is, and the Federal Hospital is there in Rochester as well. So if Leonard can get to Wisconsin, he will be much closer to excellent medical care. He gets okay medical care here, but we have been trying to get some of his problems taken care of for years. And there are thousands of federal prisoners, and you have to be practically dying to get medical care. And so Leonard has had some medical care. He's had some things taken care of that have been problems. They've also, Leonard had stepped on a nail when he was a young man. And of course, they didn't have tetanus shots. And he ended up with lockjaw, which means he can't open his mouth wide enough to, you know, to
eat solid food.
Well, he can eat it, but, you know, it's very small. And so they attempted to fix that. In fact, they almost killed him because they hit an artery and he almost bled to death.
Wow.
At a federal hospital. He had a stroke in his eye, which meant that the blood vessels in the eye all burst. And if it's not taken care of, it can cause blindness. Now, this was at the time when Gorbachev was leader of the Soviet Union. And people met with him, and he actually forced the United States government to let his doctor go in and take care of Leonard's eye, because they would not take care of it for him. They said, oh, it's no big deal. And so people went to the UN when he was there and met with him, and he put pressure on the government at that time, and they let a Russian doctor go in and take care of his eye. So he didn't lose complete sight, but he lost about a quarter of his eyesight because of malpractice and neglect. And so if we can get him to Wisconsin, we feel that he'll have access to the Mayo Clinic. He's 74 right now. He has, you know, older male problems with the prostate. You know, he has arthritis in his knee and hip. And so we're hoping by getting him a transfer, we'll also have access, he'll have access to better medical care. And if he moves there, then the defense committee here, that's here in Florida, will pack up our bags and we'll head over and find a place there because we feel you have to be close to a prisoner. You cannot be in North Dakota when he's in Florida and something happens. And so we visit him at least once a week if he wants. Sometimes, you know, he's a painter and that's the only time the art room is open, so he'll go paint. But you just can't trust this government and the BOP to adequately protect people. This place in Coleman is like a gladiator school. You know, they entice and manipulate these gangs. There's huge gang fights in the yard. And then the whole prison is locked down, which means there's no visiting, there's no yard time, you're in your cell 24/7. But people have struggled against this for so long, they've actually created an elder unit. And Leonard, along with other people over the age of 65, are in what's called an elder unit. But like Leonard said, you're fearful to go out to the yard because these fights will erupt. And many of the young people that are there, a guard might tell them to do something, and they've got such incredibly long sentences that they'll fight the guard. And of course, once that happens, then locked down again. So we're hoping to get him to a lower level security facility where he'll have less worry about that type of violence that goes on in all these federal prisons. You know, Coleman has two federal prisons. That means that they have powers. It has two FCIs, Federal Correctional Institutions. It has a camp for men and a camp for women. So it's this huge, huge federal gulag out here in the middle of Florida where you probably have 3,000 or 4,000 prisoners in one area. So it's, you know, pretty horrendous, this Bureau of Prisons. And they always put them sort of out in the country so people don't see them and, you know, don't know that they're there in their backyard, so to speak. So that's what we're working on right now. Leonard is also an incredible painter, but he has given the Defense Committee his work, and we sell it to pay for the Defense Committee, to pay for lawyers, to support other political prisoners, other Native prisoners. We have a scholarship that's given out to Native high school students on Pine Ridge. And 2 years ago, in Tacoma, Washington, Leonard's art was displayed at a Native American month that they have at a public building. And people knew that if Leonard's art was there, that it would be controversial. Not the art, but the fact that the feds, the Bureau, the FBI's agents continued to harass Leonard. And so two agents, they're retired, and one of the families of one of the men that was killed protested against this and intimidated the people that put this up, this art show up, and so they took Leonard's paintings down. Well, Leonard's son, who lives out there, sued them. And what happened was the people had the right to take it down, but Leonard had a right to be there. And this judge said, Mr. Peltier has every right for his art to be shown, that just because he is a prisoner does not mean that people that own his art cannot show it. And so we have a First Amendment case that's going on right now. It will be tried in Tacoma, Washington. The lawyer is a man named Larry Hildes, who is a civil rights lawyer. He's in Bellingham, Washington. And so, you know, I mean, no matter what you do, the FBI has this way of attempting to intimidate people who are supporters, who are people who have come to understand what racism and white supremacy is, and they still attempt to, you know, destroy Leonard's ability to struggle for his freedom. So we have that going on in the Northwest, the First Amendment rights. Trial will be at the beginning of 2020. And discovery is going on, and the Northwest Peltier Support Group is there working to, you know, build up support and funds to help pay for this lawyer.
So y'all have been very active on the outside doing support for Leonard, and he's also been very active on the inside over the years, between publishing books and doing the paintings and being involved in supporting things like Fight Toxic Prisons. Can you talk a little bit about his writing and his activism from the inside?
Because of Leonard being in AIM and the struggles for the fishing rights, the water struggles in the Northwest, Leonard has always been an environmentalist. You know, Mother Earth to Native people is incredibly important. You don't pour oils on Mother Earth. You don't frack her. You don't put these pipes in her that carry oil that will destroy the water and the aquifer. So Leonard has always been an environmentalist. It's just much harder when you're in prison to be able to be vocal about this. But we on the outside have always been part of environmental struggles. And so people have said, would you ask Leonard if he has an opinion, if he would write a solidarity statement? So we send in all the information that Leonard needs, and he would study this, and then he will write a letter of support for this, for Standing Rock, for David So Happy, for the fishing struggles, the anti-fracking movement, and like you said, anti-toxic prisons. And so Leonard has been pretty vocal about this, as much as he can be, because his mail is constantly being read. He has a person that reads his mail, just like other political prisoners. So whether it's Osso Blanco or Mumia or Tom Manning, or the environmental prisoners, Marius Marcus and them, they all have people that read their mail, and they can withhold the mail and send it back saying that we feel that this would be harmful to be spread in the federal government. And it's very hard to fight the Bureau of Prisons because the judge says the warden is responsible for the safety, and he's there, and I'm not, so I'm going to support him. So while Leonard has been very active, probably not as much as he would like to, but he's never not been willing to stand up to prevent, you know, this incredible destruction of Mother Earth, and especially around Standing Rock and fracking. You know, just has created this environment on people's land, on reservations, that if these pipes break, you know, water is sacred. Water is not just used for drinking and washing. Water is used for ceremony. And so how can you have a ceremony if you have oil in this water that's supposed to be cured and offered to the Creator? So Leonard has actively, through us, put out letters of solidarity and support. He's written a couple of books. Richard Erdos helped him put together My Life as a Sundance. Peter Matheson's book, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, is the whole history of Leonard's family. Bob and I knew Peter, and Bob took him to Pine Ridge, and he met people and spent a lot of time visiting with Leonard to understand what was going on, to go to ceremony, to build with between him and Leonard this trust that it's hard to come by for Native people. White writers often use Native people and exploit them. And it turns out, you know, that somehow the person that they're writing about is wrong and the white people are right. So it takes time to build this up. But Leonard has consistently, you know, stood on the side of Mother Earth and resisted and talked. And, of course, inside, he and other Native people go to the sweat lodge and, you know, are allowed to have some ceremonies from time to time. And within this, not only Leonard, but other Native political prisoners have put out letters of solidarity as a way to show that even though behind the walls that they're love and respect for Mother Earth cannot be stopped.
Well, for people that are listening and would like to get in touch with Leonard, can he receive letters from anyone, or does he have a limited list?
No. He can receive as many letters as, you know, people send him. And you can go to our website, www.whoisleonardpeltier.info. And Leonard's address is there. His case, his trial is there on the website under resources. We have a merchandise store. And we have his listing of his solidarity statements and reports. So whoisleonardpeltier.info is one of the ways that you can find out what we're trying to do. I can give you Leonard's address. So it's Leonard Peltier, USP 1, Coleman, P.O. Box 1033, Coleman, Florida, 33521. If you write to Leonard and any federal prisoner now, you can only send in white paper and a white envelope. There can be no stickers on the envelope. The return address must be full and it can only be written. You cannot use colored papers. You cannot send in birthday cards or anything like that anymore to the federal prisoners. Just white envelopes, white paper, blue or black pen is fine.
When you say for the return address, it has to be written, so it can't be like printed onto the.
No, if it's printed on the, if it's printed on, that's one thing. But you know how you have these return address stickers?
Oh, okay.
Those,
yeah.
They cannot use that. And they are saying that this is because of the influx of drugs, this Super K or whatever it was that has killed so many prisoners. Evidently, one of the ways it's sent in is it can be distilled down and then colored paper absorbs it. And then when the prisoner gets it, supposedly, they put it in water and there it is. So they've said just white letters, white paper, handwritten. You know, if it's printed, then that's not something that can be pulled up and something attached underneath it.
Okay. Wow, the miracle of science. Yeah. Well, Paulette, thank you so much for having this conversation. Really appreciate you taking the time and all the work that, you and the ILPDC do.
Right. And if they'd like to, they can reach the office. We're right here. We're in Tampa, Florida. And the number is 218-790-7667. And if they're in this area and want to come by, all they have to do is call me. I have Leonard's art. And they can have a cup of coffee and we can talk about his case. So it's always great to have people come by. And so they can call and come by and we can visit.
That sounds awesome. There anything we didn't cover that you want to throw in?
No, just if they go to the website, there is a place where you can sign up to be on our newsletter. We send out a newsletter every other week, and as we are sending out this information about how people can support, pardon me, Leonard's request for a transfer. We also have a Twitter account. If they put in Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, they can go on our Twitter account. We're on Facebook under the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. So there's many ways people can now support the struggles of Leonard for justice. You know, I mean, it's about time that they let him home to just be a human being again.
Well spoken. Well, thanks a lot, Paulette.
You're welcome. Thank you.